You know that I'm not wearing pants.
I was just going to talk about Vegas, which is the point of the podcast.
I'd play some mean harmonica.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things she could do topless, and she'd look good.
I've been on Broadway much more than you, motherfucker. By a lot.
Thanks.
Because the original Mr. Piffles was like beaten up by an 8-year-old.
Fuck you, Sinatra.
What happened in Vegas with Piff and Paul?
Welcome to What Happened in Vegas with me, Piff the Magic Dragon, and
me, Paul DeBeck.
Hello, Paul.
Hi, Piff.
This is exciting, the first ever episode.
It's very exciting, and I'm a very awake because this is a very bright and lively studio.
It's Piff Yellow.
It is Piff Yellow, and you wouldn't know if it's day or night outside.
That's the idea of a casino.
Right. Well, we're right
Hide
on brand.
Truth.
I love it.
Yeah, it's all Piff Yellow, and I think the idea originally was to do a Piff the Magic Dragon podcast, and I was like, I don't want to be alone.
Wow, that's the only reason I'm here.
Yeah.
That's my credential.
Yeah, you're the most available of my friends.
I would contest it, but I know it's true.
Yeah.
The least busy of all your friends.
The least busy. You could also take it as a compliment, the most interesting, the one who, the most, what do you say when you have good conversation? Not that. The most, no, you know, when like you articulate.
Yeah.
The most
ironic that it took you so long to put that together. Yeah, I like the set. I don't feel like I have equal billing.
You don't have there's nothing. There's you.
There's a terrible photo.
There's
of
a little
me up
photo on a shelf.
Zach the Squire found on the internet and placed there. So I don't even have a full shelf.
You have part of a shelf. And it's, on the little logo, we put you in.
Yeah, I'm on the logo. Well, when I saw the logo, I thought I would be, you know, this is going to be great for my career. I will be equal bill. No.
We'll put in like Comic Sans, we'll put Paul DeBeck, and then we'll put an arrow to you.
Yeah. Who? Okay?
And then on me, you just be like, you
well,
get it.
Well, no, you are. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm in disguise. I'm in my dress down dragon.
I know. It's spiffy. I like it.
Do you like it?
You are lowering the hood. People are getting to know you.
Exactly.
Instead of lifting the hood.
It's behind the veil.
It sounds like Game of Thrones now.
Let's just be honest. We've shot
five episodes.
Five episodes already.
And they're absolute. I mean,
they're caucus.
It's off to. I'm still here for a reason. I'm not just swinging on this dragon tail for
exactly.
no reason.
Exactly. When the conversation started to die down, you were right in there. Yeah. You jumped in there. You were like, let me save the show, guys.
Yeah.
On one of the episodes coming up, we got Dieter von Teese. What did you say about cats being dead, Janice?
Who said something about cats being dead?
She brought up that her cat recently died, and then Paul made a dead cat joke. And
that is what we need, Paul.
Is that?
We need controversy.
Yeah.
We need
badly
awkward moments.
Badly timed comic moments.
Storm outs.
We're putting a laughter track in, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
don't worry. The bit's going to cut together great about the dead cat.
She won't return my calls.
No. Well, it's a dead cat. Oh, you're talking about Dieter.
Yeah.
She's...
Was it insensitive?
Not the way we're going to cut it. It's going to be
great.
It's going to be great.
That episode, we could get a word in edgeways.
We could, unlike this episode coming up right now. So let's just talk about you for just a second.
Oh, wow. This is done,
it's
and then we never
long.
Have to go
it's
back
It's not
going to
be long, and we're going to tighten it.
Yes.
All right? So, first of all, you and I have known each other for 20 years?
Yes.
My first introduction to you was when you beat me at a magic competition.
Yes.
Yeah. You absolutely.
I destroyed, but yes.
Destroyed me. I was doing a very.
You destroyed yourself.
Correct. I have never self-sabotaged like that before or since.
Yeah. And from what I now know about your journey down to there, but your journey there, you were literally deciding how you were going to spend the prize money.
Yeah. We thought we had it in the bag.
Yeah. Which is so like weird because your act was like so out there. Like, my act makes me cringe thinking about the act that
you
I did.
You did a
but it
solid
was,
act.
Yeah, but it was very, like, classic magic.
It was
what
like,
you
napkin,
were doing was
napkin,
so, right.
napkin, playing cards, napkin.
Hanky.
I remember
it's like
you,
an umbrella.
I remember you bouncing cars off the floor.
I did do that, yeah. I was like a little Jeff McBride. Loved it.
We got absolutely trounced.
You had an unusual act. There wasn't a lot of magic.
We
in
still
it,
lost
there?
Badly.
Yeah, I don't think you were placed. Didn't they change the rules?
They changed the rules so that we could never enter again.
But I'm glad that we're talking about this because, like, the irony is that you went on to have your own show in Vegas with your name over the theater
and also in the room a lot.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And I have that picture on that shelf.
And also, that's your face I on do someone like else's
that.
Body.
That's not true. Did I was ever, here for that
Were you holding a fire extinguisher?
How upsetting what? Is it that I came and put that outfit on in this very studio for this photo shoot and you're telling me they didn't even use my body?
Were you holding a fire
it's
extinguisher?
A stump body. Were you on fire? Anyway, yes, we've known each other a long time, but we weren't really friends. I think it might be because...
We weren't enemies, though.
Well, I thought we were, but you didn't.
I didn't think we were enemies. I was more just disinterested.
You're like, yeah, but you're like, if a tree falls in the forest, like, do I even exist if I'm not competing against you?
Exactly.
I don't think you thought about me once in the 15 years in between.
It's like that thing they say, you know, when you're like worried about what other people think about you and the reality is they're just not thinking about you. It was that.
Yeah. Yeah. But I was thinking about you.
I wasn't. I saw you once.
Oh, you
outside a gig.
You know, you're bringing this up because we talked about this, but you don't remember it.
No,
I was crossing busy London feeling so, you know, I think I doubled up. I had two gigs. I had one in Leicester Square, one somewhere else. I was crossing London. Off I was going to my second gig feeling like a real, you know,
pro.
Real pro, really at the top of my game. And as I'm crossing with my little case from Leicester Square Theatre, I hear Paul. And I turn and it's Piff.
Me.
And he's waving at me. And I'm like, oh, he likes me. And I walk across the street to you and you go, you're right. I turn around and go back into the theatre.
I was
just went, you're right. That was it. I crossed the road with all my stuff. I was in a real busy hurry. And then you just turned around and went, you're right.
What did you want
in.
From me?
But you sounded so excited. You were like, Paul, Paul. And I turned, crossed the traffic, and then you went, you're right.
This is my problem. I don't know. I'm not, I haven't got a good follow-up.
You didn't know. I don't think you knew how that might look to somebody who's just thinks you're great.
Oh.
Now I wouldn't cross the street.
That's nice. No, it's just being friendly. I was like, hi, Paul.
But then,
and then I was like, that's it. That's all the social interacting.
But now you're like my ride or die.
We've got a whole bunch of episodes coming up. We've got Pendula is today. Talk about that in a second. We've got Dieter Von Teese. We've got Carrot Top. We've got...
Jimmy,
one of our ushers.
Jimmy was great.
Who also accidentally worked for the mob for a year.
For a whole year, accidentally.
We've got Sean, who used to play Merlin in Tournament of Kings.
Yeah.
And has been in Las Vegas.
And on Queer Eye, just like
and he was on Queer Eye. That's how I know him. So we've got a whole bunch. But starting with Penn Jillette today. And, well...
What an episode to kick off with.
I wasn't prepared.
I wasn't prepared because I... You know, you are quite well known that you're close friends with Penn. Yeah, BFFs.
No offense.
And no, I understand. And I do not know Penn. And already feeling self-conscious about, you know, being the hanger-on on this podcast, I thought, well, you know, people are going to be like, who? I'm glad we've talked about our friendship here and how indifferent you were about me for so long.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, oh, Penn, you know, notoriously quite outspoken. One, probably won't like me. Two, probably won't want me to be there. He just wants to hang out with Piff.
But you had a secret weapon.
Silence.
No. You used to be a street entertainer.
Well, that was it. Yeah, we ended up bonding a little bit over that, I think, maybe.
So depends. After you did your dead cat bit with Penn, you quickly segued into your street entertainment.
I don't know if we have the moment that he sat down in this chair saying hello to you and turned and went, who the fuck are you? But it was exactly what I thought would happen. And then I just had such a great time. He was great.
He was great. The point of this podcast is to talk about things that have happened in Vegas. That's the point of it.
Yes.
So, like, we're going to have a ton of guests, like some celebrities, some people who we just know from Vegas who've got amazing stories, like Jimmy the Usher,
right.
Who worked for the mob for a year. He worked at the Flamingo for like 50 years or something crazy.
Yeah, this place is full of stories.
Crazy. So, again, those people, we're going to have celebrities as well. And the idea is that, hey, like Penn has some great Vegas stories, but it took a while to get there, Penn.
45 minutes.
It took a while to get there. Most of the opening content is about some tortoise. What was it?
No, it was about finches in the Galapagos.
We don't want to spoil it for you guys, you know, please. You should enjoy
two hours
as it unfolds.
Two hours.
We cut it down as much as we could and to preserve it making sense.
There will be some Galapagos chat because it's referenced so much through the
episode. Beat content in there.
There's some
sweet beat content.
Sweet beat content.
Penn is one of those crazy people. I don't know. I say he's one of those. I don't really know anyone like him. You know, he's a magician. Everyone knows that. He's a writer. Written a ton of books. He's an actor. Been on a bunch of shows. Just shot a movie with Timothée Chalamet.
I was still just starstruck because I'm sitting there going, this is Sabrina's dad from Sabrina the Teenage
Witch. There you go.
And obviously that's probably the least amazing thing he's done.
He's invented things. He's got patents. So anyway, without further ado, one of my best friends, what a legend, to kick off what happened in Vegas is Penn Jillette.
There was a mosquito here. They've taken over here.
That's when you know you've made it, when you've got a mosquito catcher. Killer.
Isn't that horrible? It used to be that one of the big things about Vegas.
No mosquitoes.
There's no mosquitoes,
they're everywhere.
No fleas.
Yeah, why have we got mosquitoes?
Nuts at the moment.
We got fleas now?
I don't think we have fleas yet, but we have mosquitoes because it's just motherfucking evolution. There's a strain of mosquito that kept moving more and more dry in California and built the ability to live pretty dry. And has infiltrated Vegas and is learning because there's enough standing water from all the rich assholes irrigating everything with little pools that they can breed.
I thought it took like millions of years to evolve.
Well, no. What about the moths in England? You know about the moths in England. You also know about the
I don't know about the moths in England.
The moths in England over the period of a very short time, I mean, I probably haven't got this exactly right, but like 60 years, maybe less, they evolved to go from white to black to be able to match the smokestacks.
So they're just good at evolving?
Well, everything's good at evolving. Well, I mean,
when was the last time you evolved? I didn't evolve. I haven't evolved. This is it.
I don't know as much about dragon biology as I should.
Right.
But what is evolution, right? Evolution is essentially things that are successful in that environment or have luck, reproduce. And those that don't reproduce, and they pass down those traits. What you've got is you've got selection with random variations. If you have a dry area in California and some of the mosquitoes function well in the dry area, even though they just by random chance they're apt to breed more, then those are apt to carry the traits,
and then they come to Vegas
and they've hitchhiked to Vegas. They probably didn't fly,
and everyone's using swamp coolers, making the place more humid than it is anyway,
right?
You know,
but that's actually has nothing to do with the discussion. these mosquitoes are not primarily living in places that are humidified.
Oh, okay.
But the swamp coolers on the roof,
right,
would have a breeding ground for them.
Right.
So you're actually right.
Kind of. This is how this is going to go. I know. I'm feeling it. I'm ready. I'm on edge now. Let's go. Action.
I was just trying to do
action.
Get you going. Have we started the show yet?
Yeah,
we started the show now. Hello, it's Penn Jillette. Hi, Penn.
Hello. Good to see you. I prefer to be called Pop, please.
Pop. Yeah. Well, you're not wearing your official outfit.
Well, I'm wearing my Piff the Magic Dragon sweatshirt.
And what name does it say on your official sweatshirt?
Begins with a P.
Yes.
I was just telling Glenn the other day, this might make him upset. Is this going to make him sad?
Oh, no. Why are we starting off with
this?
This is
my favorite sweatshirt, and I wear it all the time. And there's only one thing I don't like about it. And that one thing is you've embroidered my name. So then I become a dick who's walking around with his own name on his shirt. I'm very proud to walk around with your name on my sweatshirt.
Do you want another name? Or do you want no name?
If it said Pop, it would be great.
All right, we'll just get you one that says Pop.
Because people come up and go, hey, you are Penn, and they point. Right. Like, oh, he's wearing a name tag. And, you know, when I worked as a shipping clerk at Wilson's department store, I wore a name tag. I had no problem with that. But I would like the name tag to be mandated in order to wear it.
What I'm saying is you've been suffering for no reason.
Suffering may be overstating it somewhat. Slightly
uncomfortable.
Annoyed for no reason.
Miffed.
Miffed.
Miffed is too strong.
Really?
I wanted something very gentle. Like the speed
perturbed.
That a moth gets darker.
Oh.
There's also the beaks of the finches.
Oh, we're back to evolution.
On the Galapagos Islands.
No, I don't know. No, listen, how often do you start conversations with me where you assume some knowledge that I definitely don't have? I think you should start the other way. You should go, you don't know
nothing about the Galapagos Islands.
That's it. That's the best way to start any conversation with me.
But the Galapagos Islands are very important in not in understanding evolution, because you have small colonies that don't go from one island to another often. If a finch does happen to migrate to another island, the food sources are very different. And what you find is if you have nuts, and do you have nuts? If you have nuts on your island, then your finch beaks are going to get smaller and stronger and sturdier to crack the nuts. And if you have nectar on your island, it's going to get longer so you can go in and suck up that sweet shit. You know what I'm talking about? You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
And then
suck up the nectar.
If they have insects, they're going to get more, and they can actually measure them. And over the period of a very short time, like 10 or 20 years, they were seeing marked changes in the size of the beak of the finch. Now, it turns out that that idea of evolution is antiquated. It's much more complicated than that, like your clone dog, because you have all the ectogenic stuff.
What's ectogenic?
Is it exogenic, sorry, which is the stuff that interacts with the genetics that cannot be inherited. Which is why your clone dog is not going to be the same as your other dog.
He's much more privileged.
Yeah.
He's got quite an ego on him, because the original Mr. Piffles was like beaten up by an 8-year-old for the first year and a half.
Have you found out that's what it is? Was he beat up by an 8-year-old? Did you just make that up?
No, that was 100% what happened when he was a little puppy.
Yeah.
It's like typical children of a self-made millionaire. It's like someone's come from nothing, worked really hard, really understands the value of everything. And then the next generation.
Or the way they used to say, like, shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. There's another cliche that I can't remember the exact words on it, but that very, very, and there's sexist language built in this because it's an older thing that was written, but rich, successful men spend their life raising their children, trying to give them some of the experiences they had and failing at that. Okay. For instance, I hitchhiked around the country doing shows all over here when I was like 18 or 19.
And you just wrote a book about it.
And yeah. And my children went to Edinburgh when they want to do a magic show. And there's no way to fake that. You can't take the money away because they know. You can't fake a certain kind of grit in one's life. Although there have been very, very privileged people who've done wonderful things. Darwin, I want to keep this all around Darwin. Darwin was very privileged. He was married to the woman whose family had Wedgwood. You know, the
China
plates.
Yeah.
And that's why Darwin probably never came out and talked aggressively about atheism, because his wife said to him, we have pretty good evidence of this. I'm making up the words, but she said to him, listen, Chuck, she called him Chuck, maybe. Would that be nice? She said, listen, Chuck, we've got all this wicked amount of money and we're really, really popular. And I'm willing to let you walk in the backyard back and forth all day and think about earthworms, which is what he did. Most of his work was on earthworms, walking back and forth. But listen, don't you dare fuck us up in the social circles, okay? So then Wedgwood, the wife, who was wicked smart and kind of cool, and I would have fucked her, she said, let's get Thomas Huxley. Let's feed him money under the table and have him, he was also a part-time magician and atheist, let him speak out that evolution proves there's no God. Whenever they ask him, is this what Darwin says? He goes, not really, mostly me. Although they were feeding him the money. Well, but Darwin never says, he never really says that evolution applies to humans in On the Origin of the Species. He kind of dances around it.
Welcome to What Happened in Vegas, a podcast about things that happens in Vegas.
Evolution has happened
evolution.
In Vegas, although
slowly.
You can't tell it from Carrot Top's act.
He puts new stuff in more than me.
I know. Not more than me.
Nobody puts new stuff in more than you at the moment. It's got ridiculous.
Like over the past 30 years? Is that the moment?
No.
The beak of the finch. Beak of the finch.
When I came
here. Teller put new material in.
Listen, when I first came here, You had the fish in the show, the bouncing ball. This is what you call them, right?
Yeah, these are the ones I don't like, but go on.
Yeah, you had the bullet catchers in there. Mm-hmm.
Called
and
Magic Bullet.
For a year and a half, it was the same.
Yes, it was.
For a
and
year
on
and
Broadway,
a half.
It was the same all the time on Broadway.
Yeah.
Because Broadway kind of does that. They want you to do the same show all the time. But fuck them in the neck. You know, here's something about my wife.
Oh, good. Yeah.
My wife sits at the dinner table and with awe in her voice brings up somebody's name that I've never heard of and says, oh, they were on Broadway. And she doesn't ever seem to notice that I was on Broadway three times. And the guy she's talking about was like third fiddle in one Broadway show that ran 3 weeks.
So you get no respect for being on Broadway?
None. From anybody, as a matter of fact. Working on a show with Jason Alexander.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And we're talking. The three, you know, my writing partner, me, and Jason Alexander talking. And he's going, well, you know, when I was on Broadway. And I go, I've been on Broadway much more than you, motherfucker. By a lot.
How?
And by the way, I've done more TV than you, too. Fuck you, Seinfeld.
How many shows did you have to do on Broadway?
I've done three runs.
No, a week.
Eight.
You did eight a week?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's harder than Copperfield doing 15 because ours were good shows.
Yeah.
So that's harder.
That's more tricky.
Yeah.
Also, did David step out for a break in the middle? Because when I saw him in Vegas, he would like leave the stage and show a video for a few minutes.
Yeah, that's very common. My Weird Al Yankovic, you know, shows videos.
I just saw him the other day.
He does costume changes. Yeah. And I've always been bothered by that. And yet everyone who's seen the show says to me, it's a great part. As a matter of fact, Glenn Ally, who's sitting over there, who has guided my career to the stars. And because you fuck with him all the time and don't let him really work, he's kept you at the same level.
Yeah.
But Glenn always wanted retrospectives of what great stuff we've done in the past, Letterman shots and stuff like that. And I was always against that as being immodest. I don't want people to come to the show and say, oh, look how famous we are. And the friends that I've known that have seen Weird Al's show said, no. When he shows stuff like that, it doesn't feel immodest. It doesn't feel like he's showing off. It feels like, oh, yeah, I remember that, which is exactly what Glenn said it was.
Well, I used
to
do. So,
Glenn, I think you're right about this, but I'm still going to fight you.
You know, I think there are two ways. In our show, we used to open with like a sizzle reel.
Yeah.
And that is just that. Like, look at all the things we did.
I hate that.
Whereas Weird Al doesn't do that. He goes, oh, these are like little bits that he did on TV.
Okay, that's different then.
Yeah.
When I go to a show and they open with a sizzle telling me how famous they are, I get pissed off and go, you're not that famous. Fuck you in the neck.
Well, we changed ours.
Let me measure your beak. That's what I said.
We changed ours to a...
Still on the edge?
Yeah, what I'm loving is Penn is cleverly back-referencing his evolution conversation littered through this interview, so there's no way we can cut any... Paul Daniels used to do this. There's no way we can cut any of the acts.
Who
because,
do you think I learned it from?
Yeah, absolutely. Masterful. Yeah. Wonderful. The beak's in.
The beak's in.
The beak is in. This is, weirdly, only very unofficially kind of a family reunion because what... Pop/Penn won't know is that I, in one very small episode of a pilot we filmed, played your older brother Steve.
Wow. So this is the family.
Steve?
I actually did play Steve.
Well, did you play Steve or are you Steve? Because
well,
I became Pop.
I
become Steve. By the
no,
way,
I played Steve.
You're stunning casting for Steve.
Thanks.
Really good.
Right.
I really approve.
Oh, great.
Wow.
I really approve.
Let's
that.
Get on the road together.
Our father approves of the elder son he sired.
Yeah.
That's the thing that people always come up to me after the show and they go, hey, say hi to your older brother for me. And they go, okay. And then they go, you know, Steve.
They want to do the joke.
Yeah,
and
they
I'm
want
like,
to do the joke.
Okay.
Yeah, they want to do the joke and they want to surprise you with it.
And all they get is just disappointment.
You know that I'm not wearing pants.
What's that got to do with people?
I just looked down at my knee.
Right.
And I was appalled. At the big white expanse.
You mean you're not wearing trousers or you're not wearing pants?
I'm wearing no underwear and very short gym shorts because I thought this was going to be a podcast, so I thought the head of my dick hanging out would not be distracting.
YouTube is the biggest podcast platform.
Is that true?
Yeah. So this is it. This is the future. This is what it looks like.
And if you are listening to this on Apple Podcasts, you're going to be tuning into YouTube right now.
Yeah, at this
to
moment.
See exactly what we're describing.
To see what Penn's giving us all a look at.
In his pup tent.
This is your 50th year of Penn and Teller.
Oh, Christ.
Come on, let's talk about that for longer.
I'll tell you, when it's Teller involved, you've been around Teller, 50 years seems like 75. I mean, the amount of annoyance that man can put out in an hour is an hour and a half worth. I just gave you that same ratio.
Thank you.
50 years.
Steve! Much better. You should have led with that.
I just wanted you to discover it slowly. I thought it might have been a bit more of an emotional meeting, but
yeah, that's a big emotional.
And you know who? You know who's his dad?
Johnny Thompson.
Johnny Thompson. Yeah,
I was never lucky enough to meet that one.
You never met Johnny Thompson?
Very sad. Man. I came to Vegas too late.
I always tell this story. Do you know who Lord Buckley was?
No.
Oh, geez. Do you know who Lord Buckley was?
No.
Oh, God. It's so sad. So the only person in this room that knows Lord Buckley is Glenn, right? Lord Buckley was the master of hip. And in the 50s, he was a white guy who referred to himself as Lord Buckley and spoke in an affected accent that was kind of heavy-duty jazz African-American coupled with a little bit of English for no reason. And he would do hippified versions of classics. Like he would do Friends, Romans, and Countrymen, Lend Me Your Ears with, you know, Knock Me Your Hearers, you know, that kind of stuff. The most famous thing he did was a thing called the Naz, which was about Jesus of Nazareth. And the Naz, he laid these cats down. He said, cats, those that just stay back and don't fight none, those are the ones that are going to rise to the grooviest. Right? That would be his Sermon on the Mount.
Right.
Was that a good Lord Buckley? Passable. He also did a thing called the Governor Slugwell's Parade. Boom. And he was at the time of like Lenny Bruce and early Bob Newhart and those kind of people, he was a very well-known comic who played the jazz circuit. There were very few of them. But he would go on, and his records were fairly popular, and nobody knew he was white. Now, his daughter lived here in Vegas. Is she still around? And she did not know. It was Lord and Lady Buckley and Princess Buckley. She did not know till she was 16 that she wasn't actually royalty. But Lord Buckley, who smoked an awful lot of marijuana, and Lord Buckley, who lived his life like a wild man. I mean, picture Jack Kerouac if Jack Kerouac were a comic. This all leading up to a disappointment of Johnny Thompson. And Lord Buckley would have orgies. And I mean real, no kidding around orgies, like several dozen people all fucking on the floor of his house. Just all fucking in various things. And Lord Buckley would stand up in the middle of like giving oral sex to someone. He would just stand up with his derby on and nothing else and a hard on and do like 10 minutes of stand up and then go back to what he was doing. So Johnny Thompson worked with Lord Buckley when Johnny had his jazz harmonica band. By the way, if you ever want to make real money, don't go into jazz harmonica.
Okay.
And he met Lord Buckley, and Lord Buckley said, hey, you want to swing over to a party at my house? And Johnny said, yes, I'd like to do that. So he showed up with his two other harmonica players, knocked at the door, and said, and the door opened, and Johnny looked out onto dozens of people in all various states of fucking, a huge cloud of marijuana smoke. And there was Lord Buckley, who he just met that night, standing in front of him, butt-ass naked, with a raging hard-on and a derby, and said, Johnny, come on in, man. Stop swinging. And Johnny said, no, we'll just run along. I said, Johnny, you did not go in? He said, no, you know, the guys with me, they were like much squarer. They wanted to go home. I said, you could have sent them home and took a cab. Why didn't you go in? Because you know Johnny was rather a libertine.
Yeah.
As far as I can remember, that's the only thing that disappointed me about
learning that he walked away.
Learning that he walked away. Now, if you were a jazz harmonica player, Steve, and you were invited to Lord Buckley, and there are people fucking all over the floor, and he said they were the hard on, and said, "Come on in, Steve. Are you walking in?" That's a real question.
I'd play some mean harmonica.
Yeah,
I'd be in there.
We know what you mean by that.
Yeah, you know what I mean by that.
Yeah. Do you think I would have walked in there?
Yes.
If there's anybody
that
doubts that.
You'd have answered the door, Patton. Yeah.
I would be there with him on the side, making sure he stayed hard. Piff, would you have walked in?
I don't think I would have.
I don't think you would have either.
I would have had the dog with me. I would have used that as an excuse. Oh, guys, I'm sorry. I got a dog with me. I can't join in. I got a dog.
Have you ever been to a wild nude party?
No.
You never have? When I was, this is in my book, by the way, Felony Juggler, available at all fine book outlets.
Which I read and was one of the first to read it.
You were. You read it very early.
And you gave it to me when I was having my head zapped.
Yeah.
Every day I had to sit there doing nothing for half an hour. So I read your book.
You liked it.
Yeah. I also memorized a deck of playing cards.
Good.
Guess what?
What?
I can remember more of the book than I can the playing cards.
I used to go on college radio and say, if anybody bought me a pizza, I would teach them to juggle. So they called me up and said there was going to be a party. And if they had pizza there, would I arrive and teach everyone to juggle? And I said, sure. When I arrived, turned out the party was nude and an orgy. What do you think? You don't know me well, but just guess. That I say, oh, I'll get my pizza elsewhere. I'm not coming in. Or did I take off all my clothes at the door, walk in, grab my balls, and start teaching people?
Did you eat the pizza?
I had the pizza. It was a terrible pizza.
12-inch meat lovers. Stuffed crust.
Yeah. There was stuffed crust. I remember that vividly. I did that. Yeah. And it was a wonderful experience. When I was 17 years old, 16 years old, my mother, she did not drive me to the Lord Buckley orgy. My mother drove me very, very far to Springfield, Massachusetts, which is an hour drive, to go to a juggling convention. And I met the first professional juggler I met in my life, a gentleman by the name of Tommy Curtin, who was a Southern gentleman, and he did mostly a three-ball juggling routine. And this was the very end. He wasn't really doing vaudeville. He was not old enough to have done vaudeville, but he was still playing like little variety shows and circuits. He was not very talkative, but because he was an entertainer, people expected him to talk. So he had one joke, which he delivered just like this. I had a girlfriend back home. Used to juggle topless. Looked like she's doing five. It was an optical illusion, of course. That's the joke he told, just like that. I was 16 years old. I loved that joke. And I loved the delivery. Because at that time, I was memorizing all of Lenny Bruce, memorizing Lord Buckley, studying comedy very seriously. And the idea that just this other guy who was professional in show business would tell a joke like that killed me. So when I walked in to this nude orgy, learned to jump. By the way, many people were on many substances. They were drunk. They were tripping balls. They were stoned. They were speeding. There was cocaine. None of those drugs seemed to improve people's ability to learn juggling. There was not a lot of juggling learned. But I would be standing there, and there would be a woman who was topless trying to do three balls. And as people walk by, I would say, in my best impersonation of Tommy Curtin, not trying to be funny, but trying to be accurate, going, I had a girlfriend back home, used to juggle topless. Looked like she's doing five. It's an optical illusion, of course. And I probably told that joke 40 times that night.
So when you, I did that sort of stuff. I'll like do a joke and I'll be like, yeah, that was a good bit. Mm-hmm. Now, the audience disagreed, but I'm like, well, yeah. I'm right.
So. But I mean, you could write in your show right now, you could have Jade come out and you could say, you could go from your English accent, wherever you are now, you're halfway across the Atlantic.
I'm still English.
Listen,
it's sure. A very English accent.
Sure. You don't think so. Steve knows. But you could say.
Butter.
Butter. Butter.
You know, Jade was learning to juggle and she juggled topless. It looked like she's doing five. Is an optical illusion, of course. You could put that in your show, you know, the next show you have. Because you've got Jade right there.
Yeah, she could come in and demonstrate.
So she doesn't want to work topless in your show, does she? Also, you have
I think
children.
She'd, for a bit of that quality, I think she'd sacrifice.
Oh, good, good.
Yeah.
Does she juggle?
No, she does not juggle.
I would be willing to teach her to juggle well enough that we could do that.
That's so kind of you.
In the Piff and Pop show over in England.
Oh, yeah, frown, let's do that.
They proud about Tapas performing in the place where
people. Do you have to get a license for that in the UK? No, not if you wear pasties.
If we wear pasties, she doesn't have to?
Jay wear pasties.
Yeah, yeah.
She could do it, and then she'd be juggling. No, still five.
Yeah. But I bet she'd look good juggling topless. I haven't seen her juggle topless.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things she could do topless, and she'd look good.
Yeah, I would think cooking egg substitutes, she'd look really good.
Oh, because you don't eat eggs?
I don't eat eggs. Nobody eats egg substitutes. Just eggs.
What's like an egg substitute?
Just Eggs is the brand.
What is it?
It's stuff that tastes like eggs, but doesn't have that creepy little embryo shit in it, because it's plant-based.
Well, same as eggs.
Is the show going to start soon?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the same as an egg. Well, every time I try and start it, you derail me with another evolution story.
Okay, I'll try to stay away from that.
All right.
Although, now that
the beaks did change within one generation.
No. Glenn, it gets better. We're going to get better. Stay. We're going to get better, Glenn.
Oh, we've lost him.
We've lost Glenn.
Yeah.
Well, there's the U3er still
there. Yeah.
Oh, he's getting up to
it. Is there film in the camera?
No, there's not film in the camera. It's God video. It. So what do you want to ask?
I was just going to talk about Vegas, which is the point of the podcast.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Well, there's evolution in Vegas.
Well, we're not going back there again. Mosquitoes. I'm already getting flashbacks.
Mosquitoes.
You started
with mosquitoes in Vegas.
Today with mosquitoes in Vegas. But generally, you were living the dream in New York before you came to Vegas.
Yeah, I lived in New York for about 10 years. It was wonderful.
So when did you start?
I started on the streets of the United States of America, random places, doing shows. Actually, even before that, I started playing nursing homes and little backyard parties and stuff when I was 12 or 13, back when you were a clown for Jesus.
What was your favorite pitch when you were street performing? Where did you like working?
I always have a code that no one else cares about. And my code for street performing included I would only play places that it was illegal, because I did not like the idea they put a bureaucracy on top of street performing.
Mm-hmm.
We had to go in and audition.
License, they gave you 20 lining minutes, that up, kind of all stuff. That.
My favorite place to play was Head House Square, New Market in Philadelphia. I went in and turned that into a market. I went to the police and I said, I know that juggling and passing the hat is illegal. And it's illegal because it's covered under panhandling. I would like you to come to my first show. I would like you to watch my first show. And if you believe that I'm panhandling, then you should arrest me and I will be cuffed and go downtown. But if you think I'm actually giving a show and the people are paying me for that show, then you'll leave me alone. Is that correct? And they did that and left me alone. And then the other problem is that the local stores will report you because you're taking away from them. So I went to every store there, every restaurant there in the whole area, and I bought something. And I asked to see the owner or the manager. I sat down and said, I'm going to be doing shows out here. If you feel that I've impeded your business at all, please tell me first and I will fix it. And I would move my crowds or throw people to a certain place. So they actually liked me there. So the police, for some of my shows, not what I'm saying some, probably was two shows, I would sometimes, for a joke, get the police, like four local police guys, to stand behind me. You know, four police lined up behind me. I would do my whole pitch about giving me money and da-da-da-da. And then at the end, I would say, and we're deciding how much to give me. Remember, they're on my side. And they would all pull out their billy clubs and tap them against their hands. But they ruined it because they were all laughing hysterically.
Right.
But I wanted to be really serious and do it. But I did that for a while. And the money I made was astonishing. Astonishing.
When I was first in Vegas, and I, the show that I was in, imploded.
Yeah.
I had no job, no way of earning money. And I was talking to you and I said, what was it like, you know, for you in the lean years? And you were just like, there were no lean years.
Yeah.
So you were in school, you were living with your parents?
There was no school.
No, before.
When I was in high school.
Yeah. How did you transition to the streets?
I transitioned to the streets by the day that I get out of school on a plea bargain. It wasn't really a graduation. with my parents' blessing, I had a really nice backpack, and I'd sewed into the lining $100 in cash. I had gotten a passport, and I had a notarized letter from my parents saying I wasn't a runaway. They dropped me off at the Rotary for Route 91. I began hitchhiking, and I stayed on the streets of America for 2 years.
How much of the act did you have at that point when you dropped off?
Zero.
You had no act.
I mean, I was doing juggling. You can't have zero, but in my town.
Right. You could juggle.
I could juggle.
You'd
and
be
I
doing
could
shows.
Do a 12-minute act for a nursing home.
Yeah.
But it wasn't
that
appropriate
for
a biker
for the street,
bar.
Right?
Yeah. Wasn't appropriate for a biker bar. And then I just would hitchhike. And, you know, you don't need much. I was 6'7". I weighed 190 pounds, so very skinny. And I would like to eat like a milkshake and a piece of pie every 3 days. So I would hitchhike around. And then when I got to a town, and I'd say, well, I'll go out and try to do a show. And I was terrible, terrible, terrible. And then after a while, I was good.
When you're doing the show, you're writing or you're just honing it in the moment?
Always in the moment. I'd get an idea and say, I tried this next time. And I went up in front of places where, you know, heavy metal biker bar with a really hardcore band coming out. And I would come out before that and say, before the Sons of Death Metal come out, I'd like to do a 12-minute juggling act. And they would just hate me and boo me. And I would just get through and say, well, maybe next time I'll be better. I would go into the proprietors and say, may I do a juggling act before the band comes out? And they'd say, we can't pay. And I'd say, okay. And then I would often end my act by saying, you got a place for me to sleep or you got a pizza or something? Please invite me after the show.
So when you're doing these,
yeah,
you're out there and you're bombing. At any point, are you seeing some improvement?
Oh, yeah. Every time. By the time I hit Philadelphia, I was good. I mean, I would not do a street show that got less than $200, and most of them were $300 or $400. And I was doing 15 of those a weekend.
Just reps. That's the great thing about street, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just
do it over and over.
It's not like, oh, I had a bad night at the club. I've got to wait for tomorrow. It's like you go out and do another street show.
I also did street performing very differently. Most people tried to look like they needed the money. I had an expensive watch. Had a nice suit, and I looked like you would be embarrassed to give me less than a 20.
How did you keep the suit pressed?
I had it at that point when I was in Philadelphia. I had a beautiful apartment.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I would hire a car to bring me in. I mean, this is in 1975, and I was making $3,000 to $5,000 a week.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
I mean, that's
the. Those are the lean times for you?
Those are the lean times.
Oh, my God.
So it would be about the equivalent of $18,000 a week. So I went to a tax guy, an accountant, and I said to him, I think I should report some of this money. I kept meticulous records. You can still see the record of every street show I've done. We still have that. I kept meticulous records, and I went to an accountant, and I said, I think I should pay taxes on this. And he said, how much are you making? And I told him. And he said, if you go to the IRS at your age, looking like you look, and say that you're a street performer juggling, making this money, they're going to think you're a drug dealer and they're going to arrest you. And oh, by the way, I think you're a drug dealer. He did. He actually said that. So I just kept all that money. No taxes, no nothing. And boy, did I have cash. I mean, friends of mine who were ne'er-do-wells would call up, you know, 3 a.m. and say, I just got busted. I need to be bailed out. And I would say, how much you need in cash? They're asking for like $1,500 in cash. I'd say, okay, I'll be there in an hour.
Oh, my God.
I would try to spend the ones.
Yeah.
The change we just kept in huge bottles. And then I had 20s and hundreds. And
so then how did you meet Teller? And how did you meet? And how did, because when you're with Teller, you're making that much money immediately?
Well, by the time Teller joined me, yeah, I was already good.
Right.
But Teller was the high school teacher.
Yeah.
The whole time I was in high school, Teller was teaching high school, different high school. And a guy was doing a thing called the Otmar Scheck Memorial Society for the Preservation of Unusual Disgusting Music, which was a classical music parody thing at Amherst College up in Massachusetts. And Teller was a classmate of his. Teller's 7 years older than me. Teller was a classmate of his. And he sold me a stereo when I was in high school and asked me if I could juggle while playing bass to Beethoven's Ninth. And I said, sure. And he said, could you throw plungers around me to Catch a Turian Saber Dance. That song. Can I throw plungers and have them stick around him? And I said, well, I can't do that now, but I can learn anything because I'm really good at practicing. I'm the best practicer you've ever seen. I'll learn anything. So I went and did that show when I was like 17, and Teller was reciting Latin poetry that he'd written and pretending to be blind and selling pencils. And we talked about...
Wait, what?
It's the selling pencils selling that just pencils. Added in there, but it's so wonderful.
Because he was pretending to be a down on his luck, blind street poet.
Oh.
And we began talking about art, and I told him how much I hated magic in every way and never wanted anything to do with magic. And Teller had intellectual ideas about magic. We talked about it. And then I would come visit Teller whenever I was hitchhiking through there and, you know, spend an evening and talking. And then the Minnesota Renaissance Festival, by the way, Teller doesn't know this, but he doesn't listen to this, so it doesn't matter. Renaissance Festival said, we need somebody really, really good at street performing at a Renaissance Festival, and we'll pay you more than anyone's ever been paid for the Renaissance Festival. And I said, okay. And by the way, there's this magician that I'd like to bring with me who I think would be good. And they said, we have no more money in the budget. And I said, you can give him half my money. And they said, okay. So I called Teller and I said, you can work at the Renaissance Festival doing magic starting in August. He said, that's perfect. He said, what do we get paid? And I told him, you know, it was like $100 a day or something, $200 a day. And I told him, he said, that's great. I want to do it. He said, when is it over? I said, the end of September. He said, I have to be back in school then. I said, okay, I thought you were a magician, not a teacher. Goodbye. Hung up. Phone rang a half hour later and Teller said, I'll take a leave of absence from teaching, but I won't quit. I'll take a leave of absence. And by the way, that letter still exists, and Teller can go back to teaching at Lawrence Township in New Jersey.
Oh, there you go.
And you know, the other little fact that I love is the guy, one guy who was signed, Teller was teaching Latin and Greek. And one of the students who was signed up to take his class the year he left to go with me, John Stewart.
Wow.
John Stewart says, if it had not been for you getting Teller out of teaching, I might have been a Latin and Greek scholar instead of a comedian.
Wow.
So I brought Teller out, and we split all our hats, and we split all the money, and Teller was making much, much less than I was.
And that was before or it was after the Asparagus Valley?
The Asparagus came out of that. All my money from street performing and bought sound and lights and all that stuff. And we started doing the Asparagus Valley Cultural Society.
Right. And then you get to New York, and you kill it in New York.
There's a long time in there.
Right.
There's San Francisco. There's all these other things.
Because I remember Teller told me a story when you guys were in California, and it was going great. Finally. It was finally going really great. And then you got a call to go to New York, and you thought it was going to be a disaster.
Oh, yeah. I wrote the contracts all the time. And we had, all I cared about was the return airfare. Because I thought, I even left my girlfriend in California and said, I'll be back in 3 weeks. We're going to tank.
Yeah.
We expected to tank. I still expect to tank. It just hasn't happened quite yet.
Was this for the Broadway run or off-Broadway run?
Off-Broadway run. And the off-Broadway one run was phenomenally successful.
Right. That was the big springboard.
Yeah, that was everything. Yeah, that was, I refused to do TV before I was 30 years old. So the week of my 30th birthday, I did Letterman and Saturday Night Live.
Wow, what a week.
That was a week. That was a week. I turned 30, and I was on Letterman and Saturday Night Live.
But before that, the show's selling out?
Yeah, mostly because of, really because of two people, both named Paul. Paul Simon and Paul Newman. Paul Simon, every meeting he had, he said, you got to go see Penn and Teller. And Paul Newman, even more amazing, left his credit card at our box office. He left a credit card at the box office, and he would call every day and say, I want 4 tickets for this person, 6 pieces for this person. And he bought hundreds and hundreds of tickets to Penn and Teller.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. I was told by somebody, this wasn't by Paul, that he would walk into meetings in New York and say to people, have you seen Penn and Teller? And if they said no, he would say, you're not really in show business. No reason to talk to you. Go see that show.
What sort of material was in that show?
Teller was doing needles.
Yeah.
We were doing a big Bible test. I was doing a lot of juggling, a lot of monologue stuff.
Straitjacket Escape. It was some of the stuff all stuff that actually appeared on Fool Us at some point.
Yeah.
That stuff stayed in our repertoire. It was good. It was a good show. And that's when Paul Simon had this, one of the most amazing, I think I might have told you this, one of the most amazing piece of advice I've ever been given. It was Paul introduced himself after he'd been to the show 5 times. And Paul and I were talking. And Paul said, "You can't see it. You can't see it, but you can do whatever you want now. If you want to play stadiums, do TV, movies, you're going to be fine." And he said, "You have this blinding, psychotic ambition to just move forward." And he said, "I would like to tell you that you've done it. You've crossed the finish line. There's no worry. And there's only one thing in your life that you can never do. And that is you can never be back on the stage in this little theater standing beside Teller." And he said, "If I had one wish in life, it would be that while Simon and Garfunkel were playing the little clubs in New York, that I had taken one moment from my insane ambition and just took a breath, looked over at Artie, looked at the audience, looked up at the lights and said, 'I'm here,' and felt that." He said, "I never felt it. I was so busy trying to get to here." So he said, "Just for me, would you please tomorrow night and every once in a while, just stop in the middle of a trick and just look at Teller, look at his eyes, look at the audience, look at the theater, and just say, 'Here's where I am,' and then go on." And I took that advice, and it was life-changing.
Yeah. Yeah, I...
Because, you know, you get that... You know, you get that just that drive.
Right.
You know, you can't. I try to pretend that I don't have the kind of, a lot of ambition. I try to claim that. But you can't have a theater with your name on it and claim to not have ambition.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid when I look back on myself, which I saw myself as kind of a laid back hippie beatnik, I was actually had that crazy blinding ambition. I didn't have it the way some people have of trying to fuck up other people and being paranoid and stuff, but I did work a lot. And Paul made a big difference because now I went on stage. We played the Ryman in Nashville, which is the was the Grand Old Opry. And it's where, I mean, everybody played that stage. Houdini played that stage. Houdini, Helen Keller, Martin Luther King. Plus, everybody in country music, Dolly Parton, Willie Nelson, Bob Dylan, Johnny Cash, zillions of times. And it's beautiful acoustics. It's been around, obviously, long enough that Houdini could play it. And the acoustics are beautiful. And because of Paul Simon, all these years later, I walked out on stage of the Ryman and did the first line and got a big laugh because the first line I did was, "It's wonderful in the Ryman Theater that finally the grandfathers of country music in this country, Bennett Teller, have finally come home." And there was huge applause. And during that time, I just looked around and went, "I'm on stage at the Ryman. This is what it feels like to be on stage at the Grand Old Opry. I'm standing where Johnny Cash stood, where Houdini stood." Houdini incidentally bombed there, but that's not important.
Well, that's what I was thinking about Cardini at Radio City.
Yeah,
Cardini, like the famous act with like cards, sure, and cigarettes, and
Randy Pitchford's uncle.
Yeah, Randy Pitchford's uncle, and it's 6,000 seats.
Yeah,
I'm not sure that when you're at the back. I was at the back of that theater watching Coldplay warm up, and I was like, is that a tiny Chris Martin? Is that a very tiny Chris Martin? I don't think Cardini would have crushed it, so I'm not surprised Houdini bombed.
That wasn't why he bombed. He bombed because he was doing spiritualist stuff. And
Cardini?
No, Houdini.
Oh.
Houdini bombed doing spiritualist stuff because the audience wanted more escape stuff from him.
Right.
It was toward the end of his life.
What kind of spiritualist stuff was he doing?
He just came out and essentially said there's no afterlife.
Oh, he was doing anti-spiritualist stuff. Yeah.
But it was his spiritualist show. If anybody can go back, we don't come back from the dead. That was basic. In the Bible Belt, he was saying, "We don't come back from the dead." I mean, I'm making this up. All I know is that he didn't sell out, and people said it wasn't a good show. The reviews are bad.
But Houdini's show was just sit behind a curtain for an hour.
Well, some of the stuff.
That's for the hour.
The escape stuff. Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although I believe that's exaggerated a little bit.
Oh, so maybe it was 10 minutes.
Sure. But I mean, that's an hour.
All right. So you're out there and you guys are crushing it off Broadway and then onto Broadway. Or was Vegas first?
Oh, no. We did two Broadway runs and two national tours and Atlantic City before we ever did Vegas. Vegas didn't really happen until 93, 94, 95, around there.
And what was Vegas like then?
Well, Vegas still had mob. It wasn't totally corporate at that time. I mean, I'm writing a pilot out now that may come out called Box Jumper, which is about being a magician's assistant in 1995 in Vegas. Because 95 was a magical time because there was a community of entertainers. I think there still is, but it was very strong there. I mean, every night at 2 a.m., you'd go to Hamada, which doesn't exist anymore, a Japanese restaurant that was on Flamingo. There's still restaurants called that, owned by the same people.
Wait, I think it's in the...
Yeah.
The restaurant was in the Flamingo.
Yeah, but no longer. I mean, not then. It was a freestanding building. And you'd go at 2 in the morning, and man, everybody from every show was there. And it was great because you'd get the show folk with the big makeup and still in all that stuff. And there's this wonderful... pure showbiz. And I would sit there with, you know, Lance Burton and even David, those people, and just sit around. You'd get there at about 2 in the morning and you'd sit there till the sun came up. Whenever someone tells a story like this about that's when it was, I'm also telling a story that I was 40 years old. And 40 years old is very different than 70.
Right.
So I'm also telling that. And now I have a family and so on. So it's very different. So partially I'm talking about Vegas in 95 and partially I'm talking about me at 40.
About your life at 40. Yeah.
But at 95, it was still kind of coming in that transition from mob still being active into the corporate. Because I didn't realize that happened so late still.
Yeah, it did. It was happening.
Because I'm fascinated
by this.
They
were trying to do the family thing, mm-hmm. which failed.
Right.
But they were trying that. You know, the MGM was putting
right, the pirate ship and
all that. Yeah, pirate ship shit and all that stuff. And Cirque hadn't taken over everything.
Right.
And, you know, and you'd still hang out with Siegfried and Roy. I guess the biggest thing, and I don't know why I didn't say this first, the biggest thing was every night Lon Bronson or some band were playing in the lounges. So you'd finish your show and you'd go at 1 a.m. and there was a full horn band on stage. And I would always grab my bass or a guitar and I'd do a song or two. You know, and Drew Carey would be up there doing a song or two. Everybody that was playing in town. Tom Jones, you'd be there and Tom Jones would come in a club with, you know, 75 show folk in it. And Tom Jones would be on stage doing a set just for fun with the band. Yeah, you guys know Little Richard?
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So I live in this old neighborhood, Spanish Oaks, kind of one of the old neighborhoods here. And someone was telling me, you know, B.B. King lived there with mm-hmm. when he wasn't on the road.
In that neighborhood?
In that little gated neighborhood. And over the road was a little joint downstairs where they'd go and session sometimes. You know, they're touring, but they're also home and exactly
you,
that.
You
place
also
to
had
hang
all
out.
All the places had show bands. So there were musicians like crazy. So the show bands would play their, you know, hack stuff for the tourists.
Mm-hmm.
And then at 1 in the morning, they would go out and
play.
Do like the Coltrane
session.
Shit.
Yeah.
You know, whatever they really wanted to play. So it would get really out and the music was great. And it was wonderful to just go out to a club. You're sitting there at 3 in the morning. The guy on stage says, hey, Penn, you want to do some Lou Reed? And you go, oh, sure. And he'd go up and the bass player would just take his bass and hand it to me. And I'd do, you know, a few jokes and do a couple songs and a few more jokes. And then, okay, good night. Take the bass off, hand it back, go back and sit down. It was fabulous. It's just like the way you wanted
That's
to live.
That's the Vegas we want to live in.
Right.
Yeah, well, plus, imagine if Lord Buckley were there.
Wow,
you could go over.
There's pizza. There's pizza at 5.
There's pizza every day.
I think people now, it's kind of gone full circle. People are craving in more close quarter kind of.
Well, when you get your derby in a hard on,
I'm there.
Invite me by.
Yeah.
I will not walk away.
Okay. I'll have the base ready. It's a bowler from England. We don't have derbies, but, you know.
A bowler, yeah. It was probably a bowler for Lord Buckley, too. That's probably just an American.
I don't know if it's a different hat or not. I feel like a derby's a little taller. Anyway.
I was thinking like a Sherlock Holmes.
I believe Holmes that with the flaps. On the Galapagos Islands, the Derby actually got taller by millimeters every three
over
years.
Three generations.
Because they were eating nuts. Yeah,
well, and a lot of pizza.
You told me you once got asked to be mayor of Vegas.
No, no. People have asked me to run for mayor. That's a big difference.
What did I say?
You said asked to be mayor.
What? Yeah. I said people asked you to be mayor.
To run for mayor.
Yeah, but they, right, to be mayor.
They would like me to be mayor, yeah.
Yeah, which is just, what?
And
they asked him to join the competition, basically.
Yeah. And they said they would fund me.
And they sort of did this without asking you. They asked you via a newspaper.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really a question. It was more of a...
Yeah, we're going to put money behind Penn to run for mayor.
Yeah.
Although this is not an American tradition now, I felt that if I didn't understand the job and didn't feel I could do it well, that I shouldn't try to get it.
Right.
Now, that's considered foolish now with our president.
Didn't Glenn do the math in it and figure out it was possible?
Yeah, Glenn thought it was possible. Here's what bothered me. There's a line by Neil Young. It's hard enough losing without the confusion of knowing I tried. And here was the scenario I played. And that scenario was that I would go out and speak honestly from my heart what I thought should be done as mayor. And I would do no compromise, and I would just lay it out in some sort of pure utopian way. And I would be doing okay. And then this is what I dreaded. Glenn would come to me and say, you know, you're in striking distance.
Oh, yeah.
If we just do a few of these things mm-hmm. and you change your platform slightly, you could actually
just slightly
win.
Pivot.
Then you can win.
Yeah.
And the second that I said I can win, then I can fail.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be no problem failing unless I tried.
Mm-hmm.
And I was afraid I would try because I tend to get wrapped up in things and try to do them right. So I would try to do them right and destroy myself. That's why I wouldn't do TV before I was 30. I try to understand myself a little bit and not go into things that I think will damage me, which is one of the reasons I never had a drink of alcohol or any drug in my life, because I am certain that I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. I just never wanted to find that out.
Yeah, I found it out for me. I was correct. I was all of those things. When you're being asked to run for mayor,
which is, you're making it much more formal than it was. A bunch of assholes said, we got a lot of money, but
how long was that interval?
From when they asked me and when I said
From when you started to Vegas.
This was recently. This was probably 15 years ago.
That's not recent.
Yeah.
15.
You're part of the Vegas royalty now, right?
I don't know what that means.
It means you're the longest ever headliner.
We're the longest running headliners in the history of Vegas.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. That's what it means.
Fuck you, Sinatra. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Siegfried and Roy.
Long bush.
Beat them.
Wow.
Yeah. What point did you, when you got to Vegas, you were like, okay, you know what? Let's double down. We're going to be here now and let's make it our own.
Well, see, this is something that I had a big argument with Randy Pitchford over. I don't believe in making goals that aren't purely artistic. I do not believe in that. I do not believe in goals that are venues or goals that are money. I do not believe in those. So when we got to Vegas, the idea was to do our show around the world. We had no intention of playing mostly Vegas. Teller wanted to move to Vegas because New York was so difficult to do anything. If you wanted to rehearse something, you had to get a place in Brooklyn, get a car out to Brooklyn, get a shop in Queens. Everything was really slow and expensive. And we knew that in Vegas, we could have an actual shop and we could just have this stuff. We also knew the airport was more convenient than New York. And we thought we would tour using Vegas as our base and maybe do a month or two in Vegas.
That was
our plan. Our plan was never to play here. Then we were happy with doing 2 months a year here. And then a bigger headliner than us came in and said, I won't play here unless you get rid of Penn and Teller. So we lost those 2 months a year. And then the Rio, which we had no idea was interested in us, said, oh, if you're not playing there for 2 months, why don't you play our place all the time?
The first place was the Bally Showroom?
First place was Bally's, then it was MGM.
Oh, MGM.
And then... 9/11 happened. What the fuck is that going to do with anything, Penn? Well, I'll tell you. Teller and I are both, we bristle at too much bureaucracy. And Teller and I loved being on the road. And all of a sudden, TSA, every member of the Penn and Teller crew had been in an altercation with TSA within 2 months. And right. We were hating it. And we were fighting with TSA all the time. And we were pouting a huge amount. And Teller said, fuck it. We don't need to be on the road. Let's just stay here. So the Rio wouldn't have had a chance of booking us unless 9/11 happened, which is why a lot of the 9/11 conspiracy people blame the Rio for the ones that brought down the towers. Yeah,
I've heard that. Yeah. You just sit down at the Rio. Mm-hmm. You're living the dream at the Rio. And when did you do Bullshit? Was that after 9/11?
We pitched Bullshit 1 week after 9/11, which was the worst time to pitch a show that was going to be called Bullshit. Longest running show on Showtime's history.
There you go.
There you go. And then we did Fool Us, the longest running show in CW's history.
My favorite record is the Bally Showroom.
Oh, the most tickets ever sold?
Because it's like you versus Sinatra.
Sinatra, Willie Nelson, George Carlin, Liza Minnelli, Dean Martin. We have the record in that room.
Wow.
We were the only ones to ever sell out that room.
Wow.
Now, there's a big asterisk here, a very big asterisk. The reason that Sinatra never sold out that room was Sinatra had friends. So he would give 15 tickets to his friends. When we got to Vegas, we had no friends. We were the first show to ever come in, and when they said, well, how many comps do you want? We said, none. We were also the first show that when they asked the high rollers who wants to come see Penn and Teller, they all said no. Yeah. 1,300 tickets are for sale. We sold 1,300. Now, wow. Sinatra sold 1,250 and turned away 1,000 people. Right. But tickets sold in that room, we win.
I love it.
That's great.
I love it.
And only because we didn't have friends, which really makes me laugh. You know, Teller is one of the greatest people alive and so funny and so competent. Teller and I were sitting backstage, and I had played a gig at CBGB, I think, right? And I played bass with some punk band, CBGB Umfug in New York. And at the end of that date, right, I was playing on Broadway. So I took a limo from Broadway to CBGB, played my bass, took a limo home. But at the end of the show, I remember this clearly, the guy in the band handed me $300.
I love this story.
And I went, $300. I have not had money in my hands getting paid for like 15 years. I haven't made, I used to, when I worked the streets, I had nothing but cash. Oh, I never had cash in my hands. I said $300 just for me. And I walked around going, I got $300. That I earned. So I was telling Teller that story. We were playing Bally Showroom, and Teller said, geez, how long has it been since I've been paid? Because you play, you know, occasional rock shows, but I don't do any of, I haven't been paid. I don't think I've been paid in 20 years. So we went to Joel Fishman, one of the greatest people who ever lived, who brought us out to Vegas, and who was running Bally Showroom. And we said, you know, we haven't been paid for any of these shows. And Joel said, what do you mean? We're sending very big checks out. Why aren't you getting paid? We said, no. You pay us. But we don't get the money. We don't ever get the money. And Joel said, you want the money? And Teller said, yeah. We want all the money we make tomorrow night in cash. And Joel said, you want your full pay in cash tomorrow night? And we said, yeah. And Joel said, okay. Which Teller and I were both shocked by.
Right.
What do you mean, okay? We thought he was going to say, oh,
it's
going to
take
guys,
some time.
You.
Or, yeah,
no,
yeah,
just,
yeah.
Or just, you know, you're a douchebag. Shut up. Because, you know, most of the stuff Del and I say, the answer should be you're a douchebag. Shut up. Right? But he didn't say you're a douchebag. Shut up. He said, okay. And the next night, he came back after the show you know, like an hour after the show. It took a while. And there were four security guards. And they had this large suitcase. And he said, here you go, boys. Here's what you made tonight. And he slapped it down on the coffee table in Sinatra's dressing room, by the way, that still was decorated by Sinatra. And tell him, you know, with guards around him. And opened it up. And it was just fucking full of money. And it was all like hundreds. And they were packed together and banded together. And Teller went, this is what we get paid. This is what we get paid like every night. And Joel said, yeah, it wasn't a huge night tonight. Teller said, wow, this is what we get paid. And I said, yeah. And then Teller did about the hippest thing I've ever seen anybody do. Teller just said, bring all the crew in here. Bring the whole crew in here. And Teller, as they came in, took a handful of the money, broke the bands off it, took some money, gave it to me and said, Penn, don't count it, spend it. They took a bunch of other money, put it in his pocket, and then he said, come here. And every person in the crew, he just gave them some money. No attempt to make it even, no attempt to make it merit-based. It was just whatever his fingers happened to fall on. And he said, listen, don't report that. Don't say it's your pay. Don't tell your families about it. Just go out and spend it. Because we earned this money, guys. We earned this money. And then all the crew went, wow, thanks. You know, it's not a huge amount of money, but it was a few hundred for each person. I mean, that's a large bonus. And then we sat there. And Teller went, well, okay. And he closed the suitcase and said this to our business manager. And Joel took it and said, we'll take it back and we'll count it and we'll have this put into your account.
There you go.
It was a wonderful experience.
There is something about having it, because I was a street performer in London, and I can remember, you know, going home with those and having the safety deposit. Oh my God. I remember my friend when I got pretty good at it. And I used to be going off and doing corporate gigs and other things, but I would still street perform when I was home. Mm-hmm. And I had the same sort of view. I wanted to dress kind of a little different to everyone else and be like, is he about to make it or what's going on? Mm-hmm. Rather than like he's down on his luck. So I had a similar sort of thing. Anyway, I kind of could crack the code a little bit. You know, when you start to feel like you've got the psychology and the balance right of entertainment and the spiel. And my friend, I was sharing an apartment with in Covent Garden, practically on the pitch. Came home one night and I think I'd just been dumped by my girlfriend. And he came home and I'm just sobbing into a pile, the largest pile of cash, the largest pile of cash he's ever seen, because the only thing to do when you're brokenhearted is work. So I've done like 5-6 shows, you know, on the South Bank and Covent Garden and everything. And I've just got this mountain of cash and I'm just crying into it. But God, it does feel like you've worked for it when it's like.
Also, you're part of a community. Because I remember I was very interested in computers in the 90s, you know. And I remember a stripper in town who did lap dances and all that kind of stuff. And we became, how do you say, friendly. It looked like she's doing five. It's an optical illusion, of course. And she said she wanted to buy a computer, you know. And she said, how much would this cost? What should I get? And I made her some recommendation. We went over to whatever it was, Best Buy. And that great moment where they go, well, we say, you want this, you want this, you want this. That'll be $3,800 and, you know, 72 cents. And she went, okay, and reached in and took ones. And we're just counting ones there. I mean, ones that have, you know, beer and sweat and cum.
They've lived.
Yeah, they've lived. Boom, 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 boom. And this big pile of money. And I remember Teller and I would love it. We were street performing and we would go in and go to, you know, like the most expensive restaurant in town, you know, like Bookbinders in Philadelphia. And two of us without drinks would be like $240. And just sitting there going, and there's a $50 tip. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. It's just such a great feeling. And the only people that pay in cash are prostitutes, strippers, street performers, and drug dealers. And there you are in that group of outsiders. And as Bob Dylan said, I almost went the whole show without mentioning Bob Dylan. As Bob Dylan said, to live outside the law, you must be honest. And you really know what that means when you're a street performer. You know, there's a kind of deep honesty. Finishing a show and having them just give you cash is just such a great feeling.
I don't think I could go back to it now because I see so many people with, you know, tapping cards because it's the only way to...
Oh, sure.
And it's like...
And also with microphones.
Yeah,
did
right.
Did you use a microphone?
I have to admit I did use a microphone. Not always.
Okay. But that's how I ruin my voice. It
depends where I was working.
That's why I had to stop.
If it was a pitch where I couldn't, I would use
Oh, so you didn't think you would have stopped if your voice had held
up? Oh, I would never stop.
Wow.
No, I was vomiting blood. I woke up. I couldn't talk.
I think it's better. It's like... It's easier to build a crowd without a mic, I think.
Much easier.
Because people are like, oh, this person is yelling or saying something. Also, it's interesting. It's an animal thing.
They have the power. Yeah. When I would work for 500 people outdoors where it was illegal with just my voice, you just felt huge. You felt so powerful. You know, on the end of it, I would just go. You know, people in the very back row, you didn't see the whole show. I don't expect you to pay anything. You should not pay anything. You didn't see enough of the show. I do not deserve any of your money. What I would like you to do was all of you just hold hands in fellowship and don't let anybody out of here who doesn't give me money. You know.
You still know your act, right?
Teller says, which I guess is not very nice, but Teller says the best thing I ever did with my street act. He said I've never touched it in any form ever since.
And
it's in my book. A lot of the words are in my book.
But not all. Do you think you could do it all?
Do you think
you could find some way to document it?
At the Minnesota Renaissance Festival, I may be doing it.
Oh, really?
Oh, really?
On the 50th anniversary, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, that's cool.
That's so cool.
I may be doing something because we're going to pass the hat. We said we'd pay the Minnesota Renaissance Festival, but only if we could pass the hat.
Tell me you're going to keep that cash. Because, of course, right. Because the thing would be like, oh, we're going to pass the hat and, you know, give it to charity. But you need that feeling.
I would write a $10,000 check to charity, but then keep the $800 in cash and spend it. Teller and I have always been, I guess you could say, cheap, very, very thrifty. We would watch people like friends of ours in bands who would get an advance and then go out and buy a car. And Teller and I started, they'd celebrate when they signed a big contract. So Teller and I started this tradition, which even faded away, but it was really great. Whenever we signed a really big contract, and on Broadway, that was a big fucking contract. This is multi-millions. Teller and I would go out, the two of us together, and have donuts and a coffee. And that was our celebration.
You did get donuts and a coffee?
Yeah.
Because you once said to me, when we were getting donuts and a coffee, you know, I just say to Teller, hey, we got to stop and get donuts and a coffee and say, look what we just did.
Yeah.
So he gave you that a couple of times.
We would do that, yeah. It was wonderful. You just sit there, and I think it meant more than buying a sports car.
Lance Burton
signed his big contract here, which he advertised the biggest contract ever, which was odd because we were getting paid more at the time. But
now's the time to set the record straight.
But Lance Burton went out and bought, you know, I don't know the names of sports cars. Whatever the sports car is that says on the side of it, I have a small penis.
That one.
I believe Lance got Corvettes.
Yeah, is that what he got?
I think so.
Yeah. Both he and Godot got big Corvettes. And at the same, when you're in a Corvette, you've got all this worry like, am I an asshole? Was this conspicuous consumption? Is this what I was really working for? But when you're having coffee and donuts,
you know exactly what you're working for.
We did coffee and donuts. Have coffee and donuts.
I love it.
We did okay. I've never been more proud of Teller than this. I was so proud of him. I've told this story before. We were playing the Hollywood Bowl, and it was with John Williams, and we were doing like a 10-minute hunk, right? It was some sort of charity thing. It was Steven Spielberg and big country, Garth Brooks, and all these people, real fancy-ass shit. And we were doing 10 minutes, right? So all the people in the front, they have all the tickets for the VIPs. Now, the VIPs actually have a whole tent that they're going to go, and they have catering, but there's a little chicken dinner there. So Teller's sitting at his seat, right? And Charlize Theron comes over, and I can hear her but she's standing here and she's yelling at the press agent. Why am I sitting behind Teller? Teller and Penn have better seats than me? This is ridiculous. I'm performing in the show. Why am I sitting behind them? And it was a moment when tears actually came to my eyes, because while she was screaming that Teller was a useless star that meant nothing and she should have better seats than him, Teller has a drumstick in his hand and he turns around and looks at her and doesn't really register anything she's saying and just goes back to eating his chicken
dinner.
And I said to him, did you hear Charlize Theron talking about you? And Teller said, I don't think I know who that is. And said, we have the coleslaw here. And what I love about this, it's like when you're in a restaurant and you demand something. If you ever worked in a restaurant, you know they're going to fuck with you. But entitled people don't know it. So they said to Charlize, oh, yes, yes, please. We'll move you right to the front row. Now, front row at the Hollywood Bowl puts you in front of the subwoofer looking straight up where you can't possibly see anybody on stage. And they just said, oh, no, no, certainly. We'll move you right to the front row. And she went down there all cocky, and I'm going to the front row. And what Teller's doing? Enjoying his fucking chicken dinner. And I went, this is why I'm working with this guy right here, this guy.
Coffee and donuts. That's like the Paul Simon thing that you were saying. It's like, it's just remembering that.
Yeah. Those are the moments that matter.
I feel like in this town as well, you know, there's so much excess that if you make it in the dream of the Vegas dream, if you come to it not with a hole to fill in your soul, then you're never going to fill it.
No. And I've also had, and we know who I'm talking about, but there's no reason to say it, but people who have said to me, I came here because I wanted to have a showroom in Vegas. And what the interesting thing about that is they're not mentioning what show they want to be doing. All that matters is the fucking show. Mm-hmm. I also had someone else, well, Lance Burton, I can say it, I guess. Lance Burton said, you know, once you've been on the Strip and had your own theater, you can't go back to playing one of the lesser casinos. And I said, what do you mean, Lance? We can and we're going to. We're going to be at Arizona Charlie's. You know, the career has to go in a parabola. It has to. And we will be going down to the other side. And I've told this story a zillion times. I'm going to tell that again because it's so appropriate. But I may cry during it. There was an act called Burns and Schreiber. Alan and Rossi. It wasn't Burns and Schreiber. It was Alan and Rossi. Alan and Rossi, comic and a good-looking singer. Basically, the Martin and Lewis thing. Alan and Rossi, you wouldn't know them, not big in England. But they played the Ed Sullivan Show a zillion times. And people who were my parents' age, you know, would now be 100, would be very aware of Alan and Rossi. But we were playing the Big Room in Atlantic City. And I got a phone call from Rossi. He said, hey, we're playing the lounge, the little lounge. I know you're playing the Big Room. We thought maybe you could want to come see us. And I said, wow, my mom, dad, they loved Alan and Rossi. We should go. And Teller and I very rarely go out together, as Biff knows very well. So Teller and I, just the two of us, are going out. And it was the worst environment you could imagine. The lounge was not enclosed. So it was right out on the casino floor. Slot machines banging, people yelling. I think it was like a $3 cover. They were like 20 people in there. They came out and they started doing some new material, but also their Ed Sullivan bits for these 15 people sitting there. And Teller and I are watching them. And I think that many people would just say it was sad. You know, they used to be superstars. Now they're playing this little lounge. And Teller and I have got our club sodas and our orange juices in front of us. And we're watching the act. And I leaned over to Teller and I said, you know, this is us in just a few years. And Teller looked up, smiled and said, I am so okay with that. It was Teller at his absolute best. I want to keep going until I have destroyed every memory of me when I was good. I want to keep performing until people say, he sucks. He doesn't even remember the jokes. He doesn't know where he fucking is. I want people to go, was he ever fucking good? That's where I want to go. That's my goal, because that's the parable. That's where you're supposed to go. You know, that's the way life has to be. If you can't accept dying, then you do not fucking deserve to live.
Oh, thanks, Penn. No, it's so great having you on here.
I love it.
I love it.
I agree. I think that's great. I mean,
fucking okay with that. Do you realize what that takes? Can you imagine the other magicians in Vegas going to see someone in a lounge with 15 people half watching and all this noise going on?
I mean, there's some people who say,
this is where you're going
to
end up.
But that's the work. You know, that's like back to the street, right? Yeah, exactly. You know, maybe that's what it is. It's in you guys' blood, because it's, I feel like if you've been not as goal driven by, I need the money or the this or the that, it's about the work. It's probably why you guys got so much new material always going through.
That's what we want to do.
Yeah.
It's the process.
That's the thing I love about you guys is you make a thing and then you make another thing. You don't just like, because, you know, so many of us just, you know, keep like walking around going, look at this thing we made. Look.
Well, you know, that was the weird thing. We had a magician in town who said he didn't change his show for 20 years. And he said, it's all gold. How can I change it? It's all gold. And I said to him, who says you can only have an hour and a half of gold? Right. What's that rule?
Right.
What's that rule? Why don't you have 17 hours of gold and do an hour and a half of it?
Have you guys always worked bits that are self-contained?
Yeah, although we try to bleed them. You know, we try to have references.
Because that's what screws you up is when you...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Callbacks.
With all the callbacks.
Yeah.
You know, to put something new in our show takes a lot of work.
Yeah.
You know, we're doing the Radio City show, which is 6,000 people. That's a big deal. And we think we got Jimmy Fallon is going to MC, and we got Palabolas, the dance group. We're doing a bigger show than we've ever done, and we're doing a lot of different stuff for that. And that takes a lot of planning so that the things...
Yeah.
You know, if we just write down the bits we want to do, we can end up with 45 minutes of me doing a monologue before I tell it as anything. We got to space it out. Jesus, look at this. I've been talking for like 20 minutes. Let's get Teller doing something, for Christ's sake.
Right.
You know, and that's really nice.
How many nights are you doing at Radio City?
One night. And it'll sell out. And I mean, I hope, but I mean, it's already at, I think we're at 4,500 and it's a 6,000.
Wow.
And it's, we got 2 months. So
there's only one thing left to do.
Because I have to pay.
You're not allowed to pay until you've done one thing.
Okay, what do I got to do?
Got to bop it.
You got to play Bump It.
Oh, I don't know how to play that.
Well.
Do I get to pee beforehand?
It's rhythm based.
No, the pee is going to make this more urgent. Look, you pull this one, spin this one, flip that one, twist this one, and then you hit that one as Bump It. All right. So when you're ready, you're going to hit that middle thing that says Bump It, and then you're going to do what it says.
Bump It to start. Five score. Four. Bump It. What? Keep trying.
Bump It's the middle one.
Bop is the middle one.
Bop it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So hit
four
that.
Times?
No. That's
say,
the record.
Bop it. You bop it. Twist it. Twist it. See, basically on the beat.
Five score. Four.
Here we go.
Bop it.
Yeah.
Twist it. What?
That was a spin.
The twist is the yellow.
Twist is the yellow. Okay.
One. To be fair, it's a hard one to.
So pick up immediately.
Spin it.
Twist it.
Flick it. Yeah.
And
pull it.
Pull it. Okay. Can I do this on my body instead of...
This is like a Lord... what's his name? Party.
Lord Buckley. Listen, you go look up Lord Buckley.
Oh, I'm going to.
You're
going to
love
him. Bop it. Twist it.
Oh.
You're out.
Well, you... Fuck you.
Flick it. Oh.
You're going to get part of this because this is like rhythm based.
Rhythm is no problem.
This is a bass player's like... whole thing.
Oh,
he's gonna want to have to win this.
Pull it. Flick it. Belly.
I couldn't hear that.
What did I smell it?
I said smell it. did I smell it?
Twist it. What?
Okay.
You're out. Flick it. Oh. You're out.
So I have a feeling this may never leave his sight until he masters it.
What? You're out. Flick
okay, right?
You're out.
You're right.
Foot.
Oh, what?
Foot?
You're foot?
Spit it. Oh, you're out. Flick it. Spit it. Foot. Oh,
what's foot?
What's foot?
Hip.
Oh. Hiff?
Pip. Hello. Hello.
Flick it. Pull it. Twist it. Spit it. Flick it. Knee.
Knee?
Wait, he's saying something about...
Are you supposed to bop it on your knee?
Oh, he's
supposed to bop it on those. I think so you are. I think you're supposed to hit it on your knee or something.
A new version in this.
Why did it say ball sack?
It knows you are wearing shorts. It's got. You can take that home with you.
You can take it home and set the record.
I did a terrible job. Terrible.
You beat the record.
Yeah.
Did I?
Yeah. The record was 4. So you have the record.
Okay, good.
You're our first ever guest, and you have the record.
Okay.
We saw in three minutes that arc you were talking about right there. It was beautiful. Now the
I didn't know
is
that
dead.
You had to knock it off your
I didn't
rectum. Stick it up your ass right on the beat.
Thank you, Penn, for being our first ever guest.
Thank you. I thought I've been the first guest.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to What Happened in Vegas. Don't forget to follow us wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review. Preferably a nice one, right?
Yeah. If you hated it, find 5 places you hated it and give us a star for each of those.
Yeah, if you get 5 good things from a podcast, that's enough, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.